I did want, we didn't get to finish our lesson last week, which was the work of evil angels, and we were actually going to look at some passages that kind of detailed the work that Satan and his demons did. But I'm going to try to complete all of our lesson this week, which is an interesting lesson I've had some questions about, and we've looked at a few passages that would refer to this, but we're going to look in more detail at the subject in and of itself this morning, and I want to try to get through all of this material. So we're going to go ahead and cut out the end of our the last part of our lesson and just deal with this subject for the duration of this class. And if we have time, we may come back next week and look at the remaining portion that we overlooked. But we're going to this morning talk about the fall of Satan and his angels. We're going to look at Satan a little bit prior to the fall. Now you may be wondering, well, where is that found at in the Bible? Need to establish a couple principles before we delve into that subject in and of itself. Does everyone have a pretty good grasp on type and anti-type as to how to recognize and what those are as they are defined and demonstrated for us in the Bible? Okay, well, just a quick review if you're not, and if you're not real familiar with it and you'd like to look into it more, this is a reoccurring theme that you see all throughout the Bible. I'll just go ahead and define those terms for you. The type is a person, an event, or a ceremony that is recorded to usually foreshadow some future person, event, or ceremony. Also referred to, we may call it a prefiguring example. And then the antitype is actually the fulfillment of what was being foreshadowed. To give you an example, there in Numbers chapter 21, what you've got is, once again, the people complaining, rebelling, and sinning against God. And God punishes them by sending out these fiery snakes. And so what Moses does as a means of healing those who are being bitten and dying from these snakes, he takes and he builds this bronze serpent, puts it up on a pole, and tells all the people to look at it. And whenever the people that are snake bitten look at it, they'll be healed. So that's essentially what takes place in Numbers chapter 21, verses 6 through 9. Turn over to John chapter 3 and verse 14. That was what we would refer to as our type. The fulfillment, what that was actually foreshadowing, Jesus brings to light in John chapter 3 and verse 14, where he said, you know, just like Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness for the people to see, so must the Son of Man be lifted up. And the comparison would be the snake that was lifted up in the wilderness, Jesus is going to be lifted up on the cross. Those who were bitten by the snake, who were dying, were going to look at the snake and live. Those who looked at the Son of Man when he was lifted up, who believed in the Son of Man as he was lifted up, would be healed from their sickness, which was sin. So that's how the type-anti-type relationship works, and you can read through your Old Testaments and your New Testaments and see an innumerable example of the type-anti-type that's throughout the Bible and fills the Bible. Just before we actually get to this particular issue, and it'll make more sense when we turn and we look at a couple of passages regarding the fall of Satan and his angels, let's take a few minutes to also try to understand the nature of prophecy. Prophecy has a nature that's similar to type, anti-type, and here's what I mean by that. You know, oftentimes when you read a prophecy, it's speaking of or it's foretelling an event that's going to occur. However, oftentimes, if you want to go ahead and turn to Psalm 22, there are a couple of passages there we can look at to illustrate this point. But prophecy has what's called a greater fulfillment oftentimes, which is what the prophet was speaking of, what he was foretelling, usually an event that was going to occur. Also, prophecy has a dual nature, and many times when the prophets were speaking, it had, yes, that greater ultimate fulfillment that would take place, but sometimes it had an immediate, lesser significant fulfillment as well. And I think that's what we see in much of the prophecies that are given for us in the Old Testament, the lesser and greater fulfillment, and it'll make more sense as you look at these passages here. We won't take the time to read all of those, but I'm sure you're familiar with Psalm 22. It's a messianic prophecy, a messianic psalm that was written by David. And as you just read through this and you think about this in reference to Jesus and his crucifixion, you'll see what I mean by being messianic in its nature. Verse 1, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from helping me and from the words of my groaning?" Verses 6 through 8, "I am a worm and no man, a reproach of men and despised by the people. All those who see me ridicule me. They shoot out the lip, they shake the head, saying, 'He trusted in the Lord, let him rescue him, let him deliver him, since he delights in him.'" Now, this is foretelling a scene in Jesus' life, that is his crucifixion, where he quotes from Psalm 22:1, where he's on the cross, "My God, why have you forsaken me?" we see him there hanging on the cross, reproached and scorned by the Jews as they were putting him to death. You can read verse 18 that talks about just the experience that crucifixion brought about, the terrible pain and the terrible death that it brought about. All of these were pointed to, messianic in nature, pointed to the ultimate fulfillment, which was Jesus' crucifixion on the cross. That is the greater significance of this prophecy. However, as David wrote this, do you think that he necessarily understood what he was going to be speaking of? Oftentimes the nature of the prophet was they didn't know what the fulfillment was going to be. But the lesser fulfillment of this is, these words could have been very well spoken and fulfilled by David in his life himself. They could be just detailing experiences that he had that were going to foreshadow what Jesus was going to experience when he died on the cross. Very well, and it could be David that was saying, you know, at a point in time in his life, my God, why have you forsaken me? And all of these people were surrounding me and mocking me and scorning me and rejecting me. If you think back to David's life, there were a couple instances where that could have been fulfilled. There was the instance where Absalom came in and he tried to overthrow, take David's throne. In fact, he ran David out of the Jerusalem and he sat on David's throne for a while and ruled, kind of usurped David's position. And it very well could have been at this point in time that David sat down and wrote the psalm because it seemed like by God he had been forsaken. And it seemed like the people had turned their backs on him. There was another time in his life when he was running from Saul, which he could have uttered these very same words. But you know, that's the way that prophecy sometimes works. That's the way that God works. You have both there the ultimate fulfillment, but at the same time something very relevant that spurred David to write these words. So prophecy has somewhat of a dual nature, just as type and anti-type. There's a lesser fulfillment, but there's a greater fulfillment at the same time. Now, with that being said, there's one passage that I'll look at in Revelation chapter 18. Then we'll get to the verses we're going to study related to this particular topic. But in Revelation 18, you have there another prophecy that's being given, a vision that's being given by John on the Isle of Patmos. And he refers to not necessarily something that was going to take place, but he uses as an example for this prophecy that he's foretelling. He speaks of the city Babylon. So Babylon going on, you know, has its roots all the way back to the Tower of Babel. And when you think of the city of Babylon, which he uses in the book of Revelation to speak of a futuristic empire that's going to come about, he reaches back to times past, to the city of Babylon that took Israel into captivity and was known throughout the world as being a very, very evil nation. So I wanted to just stop and explain that about prophecy before we actually delve into our text, because it's going to help those things make a lot more sense. You'll see why when we get to these two passages. So, regarding the fall of Satan and his angels, and you knew that this was going to be one of the texts, go ahead and turn in your Bibles, Isaiah chapter 14. Isaiah chapter 14. I had to do a lot of study on this in preparation because, and granted, I want you as Bible students yourself not just to take what I say and run with it and follow my interpretation, my understanding of these texts. I want you to study these things for yourself. If you come to the same conclusion, that's great. However, if you differ from me in what you see, that's fine. I'd be happy to entertain any comments, any thoughts that might lead to a different conclusion than the way that I understand this. But I did spend a lot of time looking at these passages over the last week. Spent a lot of time talking to several other preachers that were much more knowledgeable, much older, much wiser, much more experienced than I am, asking them what their thoughts were on the understanding of these passages regarding Satan and his fall. There are primarily two passages that are referenced in regard to Satan and his fall, one of those being here in Isaiah chapter 14. So take everything that we look at with a grain of salt. You interpret it, you understand it, you appreciate it, you study it yourself. And if we come to the same place and we're able to agree on its interpretation, that's great. Just wanted that to be known on the outset before we actually get into looking at these passages. Okay. Now, 12 through 14 are the verses that usually come into question whenever we talk about Satan and his fall. So let's just go ahead and read that, and then we'll examine the context. As always, context is always important in gaining an understanding of what's being spoken about. Isaiah 14, beginning in verse 12. How you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning. How you are cut down to the ground. You have weakened the nations, for you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will also sit on the mount of the congregation. On the farthest sides of the north, I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Okay. We've always, and scholars for the many years, have looked at this passage here and said this here is describing the fall of Satan. And at the same time, they have associated this name Lucifer with Satan, saying, well, before he fell, before he sinned, before he transgressed God and was cast out of heaven, this was his identifying name. Similarly, as we have Gabriel, who we know was the name of an angel, and Michael, who we know was the name of an archangel. Many people say this passage here, talking about Satan, talking about his fall, Lucifer is who he was before the fall, came to the earth, and he became known as the adversary, as Satan. We need to gain an understanding of this name. The Hebrew word for Lucifer is the Hebrew word Hallel. And it is interpreted, were interpreted 100% correctly into our English language, it would be interpreted as light bringer, light bearer, morning star. However, you may wonder, where did the translation Lucifer come from? King James Version, if that's what yours is, and if you're not reading from King James or New King James, the years may say son of the morning or son of the dawn or morning star or something to that effect. But if you're reading from King James or New King James, then it's going to say Lucifer here in Isaiah 14 and verse 12. The reason for that is because the King James, whenever the scholars were interpreting the language, they translated this specific part of the book of Isaiah from Jerome's copy of the Latin Vulgate. Now, Jerome, I believe, translated that Bible in 300 or 400 AD, and he translated it into Latin. It was his understanding the Hebrew word Hallel was referring to the planet Venus. And so he translated that into Latin, which the Latin equivalent is Lucifer. So when it's translated into our English language, it's not translated correctly, most accurately. And so we kind of lose some of the intended meaning that the Hebrew had whenever this prophecy was initially given. And when you consider that, it wasn't until later that this passage was understood to be speaking of Satan, and thus the affiliation of the word, the Latin translation Lucifer, is then associated with the name of Satan, because many people later begin to interpret this as the fall of Satan. And so as a result, we've now got this name that is synonymous with Satan, that is Lucifer. So we want to determine, based off of this passage here, based off, more importantly, the context itself, is this talking about the fall of Satan? Can we understand this passage to be talking about the fall of Satan? I'm just going to go ahead and give you my thoughts on the outset. I don't believe that this passage is talking about the fall of Satan, and I'll explain to you why as we look at the context. Let's just go ahead and kind of examine that. If you consider who this prophecy was spoken against, verse 4 tells us that in Isaiah chapter 14, verse 4, Isaiah is given the command, take up the proverb against the king of Babylon and say, how the oppressor has ceased, how the golden city has ceased. So it's directed to the king of Babylon. The king of Babylon was one who was very exalted in his own eyes. He was one who viewed himself and his laws to be regarded as supreme. Now, I didn't actually look into a whole lot as to who the king of Babylon might be that it was referring to. Just to give you an idea, many people believe that to be Nebuchadnezzar's father, but I didn't actually look into that myself in great detail. But many believe that to be Nebuchadnezzar's father that's being spoken of, lifted up with pride as king of Babylon, that's being spoken out against here in verse 4. And you can tell that this man is obviously very boastful, because as he's speaking of this morning star that had fallen, that was going to fall, in verses 12 through 14, remember the statements there, I will, it's referred to as the five I will statements, I will ascend into heaven, I will sit on the throne of God, those statements there made in verses 13 and 14. It's obvious as God is pronouncing judgment on this man, he had a very high opinion of himself and of his law. He had essentially deified himself, made himself God, made him himself an object of worship. Let's just read a few of these other verses to gain the context of this passage. Let's look at verses 9 through 11, and I'll take any questions that anyone has after we finish looking at these verses. But let's look at verses 9 through 11. regarding this man and this prophecy that's being spoken against him. Verse 9, hell from beneath is excited about you to meet you at your coming. It stirs up the dead for you, all the chief ones of the earth. It is raised up from their thrones, all the kings of the nations. They shall all speak and say to you, have you become as weak as we? Have you become like us? Your pomp is brought down to Sheol, and the sound of your stringed instruments. The maggot is spread over you, the worms cover you. Verse 16, those who see you will gaze at you and consider you, saying, is this the man who made the earth tremble, who shook the kingdoms? Verses 19 and 20, you are cast out of your grave like an abominable branch, like the garment of those who are slain, thrust with the sword, who go down to the stones of the pit like a corpse trodden underfoot. You will not be joined with them in burial because you have destroyed your land, slain your people. The brood of evildoers shall never be named. So the judgment on this king of Babylon, who was this prophet was being pronounced against, was essentially the fall of his kingdom, the loss of his life. That was the judgment that he had for deifying himself. Now, it's within this context that Isaiah refers to the king of Babylon as the morning star, as Lucifer, as it's translated from the Latin, but as the morning star, as it can more accurately be translated into our language, son of the dawn, son of the morning. The idea behind that sort of symbolism, it depicts this once shining star. He was once the most powerful king of the most powerful nation in the world. And we can go and we can look at other passages that depict the falling of kingdoms and the falling of those kings. This describe them in apocalyptic terms that demonstrate or identify them as a fallen luminary, if you will. And so what we have here in verse 12 is really no different than what we see as the Bible speaks out, God's prophets speak out against other kings that are going to be judged and overthrown because of various sins, as one of these falling luminaries. And this one particular is referred to as the morning star. So there's a couple of other passages if you want to jot those down. Isaiah 13:10 and Ezekiel 32:7 that describe or give the same demonstration, these falling luminaries that once shined brightly in power and authority and reputation, but you know, when a star falls, it completely burns out. There's nothing left. And that was what was going to be the judgment that was brought on them because of their sin and because of their transgression. So remember, it was Jerome who translated the Hebrew word hallel into the Latin word Lucifer. Then scholars took that and ran with it based off of some of the statements made through 12 through 14. Yes, sir. Okay, what is yours translated? Okay. Right. Now it's King James and New King James that refer and translate what yours translated as Son of the Dawn, Morning Star. That is the most correct translation. That's translated specifically from the Hebrew. And the reason that Lucifer is in the text of the King James and the New King James is because they borrowed from Jerome, who translated Lucifer, the Hebrew first into Latin, and his Latin translation was Lucifer. So we've got our New King James, who is thus translated from a less correct version, a less correct language, and as a result, Lucifer is how it's translated in those versions. Like you say, you pointed out it's Morning Star, son of the Dawn. Is that what it was? That's the most correct translation. And it really removes the perception that many through the years have gained that he's speaking here of a certain individual through use of a proper name, that is Lucifer. Right, right. But as John said, that's one of the reasons that this I believe this error in interpretation has occurred through the years. But I've got a few more reasons myself as to why I don't believe that this text here is talking about Satan and his fall. For one, there's nothing within the text itself that necessitates Isaiah describing anything other than the fall of a mortal man. Now, we have here these proclamations, and that's what some have looked at and attributed to the words of Satan. You know, I will rise up higher than the heavens. I will sit on the throne of God. But it's very possible, if you especially consider the rulers during the times of the people of the Old Testament, the Egyptians, for instance, their pharaoh in their sight was a god. He was a deity. And so if you've got someone like that, or you've got one in this position of power, sure, he would make proclamations and he would make statements such as, I'm going to sit on the throne of God, because in his mind, that's who he is. And I see nothing in this text that necessitates Isaiah here speaking of anything aside from the fall of a man that had been lifted up with pride. Secondly, we see here in regard to this prophecy, this Babylonian king that was called a man, his body was going to be eaten by worms. Satan is a spirit. Satan has no body. And so thus it wouldn't make sense for that to be applicable to him. You know, the king lived and reigned over a golden city. And I think that's back up in verse 4. The golden city had ceased. Satan has a spiritual realm of darkness over which he reigns. And then the I will statements, which are why people have taken that and attributed that to being the fall of Satan, verses 13 and 14, I will ascend into heaven. Well, Satan, if this is talking about Satan before his fall, where would Satan have been? He would already have been in heaven. So it would make no sense for one in heaven to say, I will ascend into heaven. But it would make sense for a man who was on the earth to say, I will ascend into the heavens, or I will ascend into heaven. When Satan said, if this were Satan speaking and he said, I will be like the Most High, that wasn't what Satan wanted. Satan wanted to be the Most High. He didn't want to be like God. He wanted to be God. So as these statements are made and as the context is examined, I don't believe there's very strong evidence for this passage here referring to the fall of Satan, or Satan before the fall, and then what might have brought that fall about. Rather, what I see here is a man that has made himself a deity, and God is bringing judgment on him because of his self-exaltation. Any comments, any questions on this passage here? I know we didn't cover that clearly and that thoroughly. Okay. Well, if not, and anyone has anything that they'd like to bring up or point out after services, I'd be happy to revisit any of those. Let's look at one more passage, and we're going to spend the rest of our time here this morning. It's in Ezekiel chapter 28. Ezekiel 28, I said that there were two passages that spoke about perhaps Satan before the fall, at least that are recognized by scholars and Bible students, that refer to Satan before the fall, one of those being Isaiah 15:14, which I believe that we can debunk as we look at the context and make the determination. Isaiah was simply bringing out a prophecy against a man that had deified himself. But Ezekiel 18 has a different ring to it. You'll notice this just as we read through the text. There are things present in the reading of Ezekiel chapter 28 that I don't believe can be made in application to a king. Now, the nature of this is similar. Ezekiel's going to speak out, just as Isaiah did, against a king, against a ruler. Now, the things that Isaiah said, there was nothing there in my mind that needed to be attributed to a deity or an angel or a spiritual being. However, the overtones of Ezekiel 28, I believe, stand in stark contrast. I believe an argument can be made regarding the things that Ezekiel saying. Now, even though they were spoken toward a king, remember, the dual nature of prophecy. Sometimes it had to it, it foretold of something that was going to come, but at the same time, it used something to foreshadow what was going to actually take place. We looked at Revelation, how although it was a prophecy, it reached back in history to an event that already occurred, and John uses elements of things that took place in Israel's history, such as Babylon, to foretell the downfall of this great empire that was going to come about. And that's what I think that we see here in Ezekiel chapter 28. I do want you to study these things for yourself. Give consideration to them yourself. You know, I spend a lot of time studying this, but my study is my study. And you need to give consideration to these things as well before you make a determination on what these things are talking about. Let's read Ezekiel 28, 11 through 17, and note how this stands out separate and apart from the text of Isaiah 14. Now, this is a prophecy spoken by Ezekiel to a king. Verse 11, moreover, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, take up a lamentation for the king of Tyre, and say to him, Thus says the Lord God, you were the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and beauty, and perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering, the sardius, topaz, and diamond, beryl, onyx, and jasper, sapphire, turquoise, and emerald with gold. The workmanship of your timbrels and pipes was prepared for you on the day you were created. You were the anointed cherub who covers. I established you. You were on the holy mountain of God. You walk back and forth in the midst of fiery stones. You were perfect in your ways from the day you were created, till iniquity was found in you. By the abundance of your trading, you became filled with violence within, and you sinned. Therefore, I cast you as a profane thing out of the mountain of God, and I destroyed you, O covering cherub, from the midst of fiery stones. Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your splendor. I cast you to the grounds. I laid you before kings that they might gaze at you. Now, are you able to tell some differences in the language that's used here in Ezekiel in contrast to the language that was used by Isaiah? There are a couple of phrases and a couple of things that Ezekiel says in regard to this proclamation against the king of Tyre that are different than what was the language that was used to describe the fall of the king of Babylon in Isaiah chapter 14. Now, there is no conclusive statement. Let me just say this. There is no conclusive statement based off of the things that we've just read, excuse me, in Ezekiel 28 that would allow us to say this is referring to Satan and his time before the fall and then his downfall. There's nothing in there so clear-cut that will allow us to draw that kind of conclusion. However, as I said before, there is evidence that allow us to understand that perhaps, as the nature of prophecy sometimes is, an event that had already taken place was being used to foretell or foreshadow an event that was going to take place, which was the falling of Satan and then foreshadowing the falling of the king of Tyre. So, you know, let's look at the description of this king, and as we did with the other, look at the context and be fair with ourselves in regard to that, first and foremost, and then make the determination of what's being talked about here. If you look at a description of this king, he was wise, he was wealthy, and he was powerful. And verse 14 tells us he was established by God. Now, in the midst of this, as he was there in the midst of these fiery stones, they were numerous in nature, they glowed and they sparked with life. In the charge against him, verse 16, you became filled with violence. In verse 17, he became prideful. Now, because of his pride, God was going to cast him down. God was going to remove him from that place of exaltation as the mighty king of Tyre. You know, think of that passage, James 4, 6. God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. This man had, just like the king of Babylon, he had exalted himself. He had become prideful in his own eyes. He had been caught up in the work of his own hands. And as a result of that, because of that pride leading him to sin, God was going to remove him from that place of exaltation. Now, we've only got 5 more minutes. Let's try to look at some of the other elements that we can read here that would give us evidence and give us cause to think that there may be something more to this text than just a pronunciation of judgment against the king of Tyre. The language used here seems to refer to an event that occurred that God is correlating to the king of Tyre. There's certain things that are spoken here, and yes, I understand prophecies are figurative in nature, but there's certain things that are spoken here that could not refer to the king of Tyre. Verse 12 says you were the seal of perfection, you're full of wisdom, and you were perfect in beauty. That perhaps could be construed to be understood as a charge against an individual. However, I think that we can see as we look at some of these others, that doesn't always apply. Verse 13. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Now, that could not have applied to this man here. And remember, that's what's being spoken of, the fall and the judgment brought against the king of Tyre. It says, you were in Eden, the garden of God. That can't refer here to this man. That was thousands of years ago, millennia ago. The anointed cherub who covers. He's identified here twice as the anointed cherub who covers. Now, you remember our study on cherubim. And those are very type of spiritual being, a spiritual guard that are mighty, that are powerful. And in verse 15, perfect in your ways. So we've got there some descriptions that can be attributed to the king, a man who was perhaps full of wisdom and power. But we've also got some elements here that cannot be associated with the king of Tyre. That is, that he was in Eden, the garden of God. And that he was referred to as an anointed cherub. Now, some have said, well, this is talking about Adam. Is it talking about Adam? Once again, you know, the problem I see with that, verse 14, is referred to as the anointed cherub. Adam was not a cherub. A cherub is a spiritual being. And an anointed cherub would have been a spiritual being, and Adam was a man. So it doesn't make sense for what was talking about here to be talking to Adam. Verse 17, the charge he brings against him, one of the charges, your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. As we read through the Genesis account in Genesis chapter 4, what was Adam cast out of the garden for? It wasn't because he fell so in love with himself because of his own beauty, but rather his pride prevailed in that situation. He ate from the tree of knowledge of good and evil to have his eyes opened, if you will. So some of the similarities are there, but there are other glaringly obvious differences. And it makes more sense that this passage here be speaking of someone else. And someone else would be Satan. You consider some of the characteristics of Satan before the fall. And like I said, I've spent a lot of time in reading this and talking to other preachers about this. These are the conclusions that I've come to. You've got to make your own, so take these with a grain of salt and understand them for what they're worth. Use them as a springboard for your own study. Verse 12, the second part of verse 12, we do. If this is speaking of Satan, then we learn some things about Satan before the fall. We learn that he was full of wisdom, that he was perfect in beauty. Now, you know, as we've looked and we've considered angels, there seem to be somewhat of a hierarchy or classification. You've got your ordinary angels, you've got, likewise, your cherub, your seraphim, your archangel. The one that's spoken about here is described as being full of wisdom, being perfect in beauty. In verse 13, you were in Eden, the garden of God. What it seemed to refer to is a description of Satan before he fell, prior to man's fall, Eden before man's fall, not the garden of Eden that had fallen when Adam ate of the tree, but rather before, when God and man were in cohesion and coexistence together before the fall. That's where Satan appeared to have been. You know, Satan doesn't show up as Satan until Genesis chapter 3, where he entices Eve to eat from the fruit of the tree. Verse 14, you are the anointed cherub that covers. So we've looked at different classifications of angels, and the cherubim were a class all to themselves. You know, they were described as having those four faces and guards of God. You know, they guarded where God resided. And so they were powerful beings, and their appearance stood in contrast to others. Now, we referred to Satan as a fallen angel. I think perhaps this passage here might give us a better understanding of that. Not a mere ordinary angel, but an angel that's described as being perfect in beauty, perfect in knowledge, and as he's referred to here as a cherub, or one of the cherubim, one of those mighty, powerful angels that we've examined, that we've looked at. Some believe that perhaps Satan was an archangel, since he's referred to in Revelation chapter 12, Satan and his angels went to war with Michael and his angels. Some have referred to him as an archangel, but he's identified here, if this is indeed Satan, as a cherub. So, one of the things that we conclude, Satan was an angel of wisdom, he was an angel of beauty, he was an angel of glory, he was an angel of power, a cherub of power. But he forgot that. In verse 14, the second part of that says, God says, I establish you. Just as the king of Tyre thought that perhaps he had amassed his power and his wealth and his glory and his splendor on his own, that's the one that's being addressed here in Ezekiel chapter 28. This beautiful anointed cherub that's perfect in wisdom and beauty, God said, I established you. And the one that was spoken of here that sinned forgot that. Despite the beauty, despite the power and the wisdom, it was God that made him. So the language here and the overtones that describe the king of Tyre and his sin, I can't help but think that they have more significance than what's spoken of here as Ezekiel pours out this proverb against the king of Tyre. And it seems to me that they point to a prior event that occurred. So that's all I'm going to say on that particular issue. Does anyone have any questions or comments that they'd like to ask at this time, something that we can give more thought to, or perhaps a different perspective that might allow us to see this in a different light? Well, as we looked at in both Isaiah 14 and in Ezekiel 28, there are many of the things that Ezekiel said that we just read about that we can specifically apply to the king of Tyre. And, you know, as we looked at prophecy, often it had a foreshadowing event, and then there was a fulfillment of that event, kind of like how John in Revelation reached back to Babylon, which is something that people would have known and would have understood. It was a part of their history, foreshadowing the Roman Empire. As I look at these things, there are some definite correlations that can be made that in Ezekiel descriptions that can apply to the king of Tyre. But as I'm reading it, But it can't all apply. I can't explain why he describes why he would be describing the king of Tyre as an anointed cherub, or why he would describe the king of Tyre as having been in Eden, the garden of God. And you know, it's because he refers to those things. I have to think that there's something deeper here than just that particular event. That's, like I said, that's my understanding of it, but I would be happy to discuss and entertain other thoughts.